Thank you. Great to be here. And I'm going to talk about a project that's been long in the planning stages and only now just getting underway this summer. It's a major project that uses this telescope, Keck 2 telescope, on the summit of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. This is my team at Berkeley. Jeff Newman and Darren are postdocs. Allison is a senior student, and Brian, Michael, and Renbin are younger students, just joined this year. The total collaboration for this project is quite large by astronomy standards. Sandy Faber and I are the PIs of the program. She was in charge of building the instrument, and I'm directing the science program. Other people are joining us from Santa Cruz, from Caltech, particularly Richard Ellis and Chuck Steidel. Lupino and Kaiser provided the photometric data that forms the catalogs for the survey. Connolly and Eisenhardt are providing outside expertise, and Doug Finkbeiner was a student of mine and is now still working closely with us on pipeline issues. And Greg Worth is an important person at Keck for our purposes. So the whole motivation of this study is to look back and use the telescope as a time machine to study the universe as it was at half its size, at redshift 1. And the goal is to generate a sample of galaxies and derive, with that sample of galaxies, to study the properties of the galaxies and the clustering underneath to see how the universe has changed from the past to the present. For example, in hierarchical models of clustering formation, one can jimmy the initial conditions to make the structure amplitude about the right level at the present epoch. You have a degree of freedom to do that. But then if you say, okay, that's fixed at the present epoch, what does that universe, this particular model universe, look like at redshift 1, then that's quite dependent on the cosmological model. In the standard lambda CDM model, the evolution of structure between z of 1 and 0 is fairly subtle, whereas in the standard high-density cold dark matter model, the evolution is quite dramatic. So you get, by looking at the evolutionary aspect, one has new handle on structure formation and cosmological evolution.
Mark, what were you assuming for the lambda domination there?
That particular model was standard lambda.
70%,
yeah. Of course, that's one of the things we want to understand, is what model fits best to our data. Okay, so this large program with a large team has a diverse set of science goals, and I'll roughly categorize them into four catalogs, and I won't be able to talk about them in detail. One is to study the properties of the galaxies individually and ask how they've changed at z of 1 compared to today. Two is, as I mentioned, to study the clustering of the galaxy distribution at the 2 and 3-point level at least, and whatever other statistics we can do. This will tell us how the galaxy bias has changed with epoch, among other issues. Three is to look at distortions in redshift space at z of 1. This is absolutely unprecedented to do this, but we will be able to do it, to see how the galaxy distribution deviates from smooth Hubble expansion. This will be expected, and this again gives us handles on the galaxy bias. And finally, four, and I will talk about this at the end of the talk, is to do some unusual cosmological probes to measure the distribution function of galaxies and clusters of galaxies as a function of an internal velocity, either velocity dispersion for the galaxies, the internal velocity width for the galaxies, or velocity dispersion for the groups of galaxies, and use this to set constraints on cosmological parameters. In particular, I'll show that we can measure the equation of state W to surprisingly high precision by this test. Now, we really are doing two surveys at once. The main survey on which I will focus today is the one-hour survey, meaning we integrate for an hour on each field. It's going to cover, in total, 3.5 square degrees with roughly 60,000 plus targets, and if all goes well, we'll have 50,000 successful redshifts over a large volume. And it will take, we're scheduling 90 nights on the Keck telescope for this side of the survey, to our magnitude limit of 24th, and we will get line widths for a large fraction of these objects. which is unusual data that I hope will be useful. The time is coming from a UC allocation and from a Caltech allocation over a 3-year period that began this last July. The 1-hour survey is being executed in 4 fields on the sky that are spread by roughly 3 hours from one to the other, so that there's always one field overhead during the months of April through October. So we just ended the observing season now, this last few days. Each of these fields is about a square degree in a 30 by 120 arc minute rectangle, except for field 1, which has an 8-to-1 aspect ratio. And I'll explain the difference for that in a minute. In 3 of the 4 fields, these 3, we are going to make a photo Z cut. We're going to pre-select a sample of galaxies to delete everything whose estimated redshift is less than 0.75. This throws away the foreground and allows us to concentrate on the background universe. Each of these volumes in space is really quite substantial. This is quite model dependent, but this is roughly the volume we'll survey per each of these 4 fields. It's being executed at high dispersion with a 1200 line grating, giving a spectral window between 65 and 9100 angstroms. And that puts the oxygen 2 doublet, prominent doublet of star-forming galaxies, will be in range in this redshift window, actually to 1.5. We're working with a 1 arc second slit, and our velocity resolution translates to 68 kilometers a second, which is very high for faint galaxy work. Now, as I mentioned, we have photometry based on a large camera in Hawaii for all of these fields. And we have 3 colors in that photometry, R minus I, B minus R, BR and I colors was taken for that. And what's shown in this plot is a trajectory of different types of galaxies. For example, elliptical, lenticular, spiral A, B, C, showing how they are expected to evolve in redshift. And the tick marks are shown at intervals of 0.2 in Z. And the curve changes color, changes from dash to solid when we cross Z equals 0.7. So all galaxies are expected roughly to evolve in color space. This is just K corrections we're looking at here. And if you draw a line like this and say everything to the right is at high redshift, everything to the left is at low redshift, it's actually very effective at selecting a sample for our purposes.
Mark, can you go back one second?
Yeah.
Okay, so your starting point.
These are theoretical models with the filters that we have for this data, showing that for different spectral types, as a function of redshift, the energy distribution of the galaxies should move them in this color space.
Right, I understand that part, but where is your Z equals 0?
Z equals 0, you have to go down here. It tends to be a band in this region. Okay, so we make a cut here, and actually it's a little more complicated, and I'll show you in a moment how it works. Okay, just hang on a sec. Let me look at the next slide, Phil, and you'll see. This is the similar color space, B minus R, R minus I. Now for actual data. This field in the so-called growth survey strip region, there's a large sample of redshifts that exist. And the objects in blue have measured redshifts, not photo Z, but real measured redshifts less than 0.75. And the objects in red have redshifts, measured redshifts greater than 0.75. So therefore, if we apply a color cut along this locus of that dashed line, we will effectively delete the foreground and keep almost all the background. The motivation for this is to allow us to use our precious slit real estate on this spectrograph for the background galaxy so we can get a dense sample at high redshift. Let other telescopes worry about the foreground universe. We're trying to study the universe at Z of 1.
You can get a preliminary cut just based off the metric Z?
That's right. That's in 3 of the 4 fields we're doing that. And that's the idea. This is an unusual approach, but we have so many objects per square arc minute, we have to make cuts. We can't get them all. And so we're trying to focus on the distant universe by such a color cut. And this is very, it seems to be very robust.
But But then you're biasing yourself into a certain regime of galaxies, right? Because you could have a galaxy which doesn't fit your standard evolutionary track with Z, which is in fact, you know, with
Z. Well, that's right. And we can measure that bias by one of the four fields will not have this photo Z cut. That's the growth survey strip. We're going to do everything. We're going to do it over a narrower field. So there's a trade on exactly what you're looking for. We want to get large volume at high redshift, yet we only have a certain amount of telescope time. This is one way to do it, and we will calibrate the biases induced by this other test. Here shows an example of a very small...
Mark, can I just make sure I understand what you're doing? There are two kinds of redshift. One is you just actually measure the spectrum.
That's right.
And the other is based on this empirical or analytic curve.
It's a semi-analytic process because they take observed spectra of different classes of galaxies and then say, how will this transform with redshift?
Right. So then by looking at the blue versus red and so on, I mean, the color distribution,
You can tell. Which, yeah.
Has it been tested that two kinds of redshifts agree very well?
They agree well enough.
In what range of redshifts?
Well, for our purposes, we're not trying to, all we're trying to ask out of the colors, the color information, is whether this object is in our sample and should be targeted for further spectroscopy. Right, okay. We're not trying to get a precision redshift, we're just trying to get a cut. That's all, so just and it throws away half the sample, which is important because we have way too many objects to cope with. And so you got to cull the sample somehow.
Oh, I see.
Now here shows what a typical piece of sky looks like. This is 200 arc seconds square, and it's a color image out of one of Kaiser's sections of his data. And these little slitlets here show what our slits are going to look like targeted on top of these objects. All right? So now the data from Nick comes in patches of the sky that are about 28 by 42 arc minutes. And what's shown here are 42 or so slit, about 40 or 42 slit mass that are going to be targeted for this region. Each dot is a galaxy that's in the mask. And there's an adaptive tiling algorithm in here to try to keep the surface, the number density per mask about the same. We have the mask tilted either to the west or to the east in order to have what's known as parallactic angle effects minimized. So considerable effort has gone into this, and this shows you what the masks look like tiled on the sky. And we have 13 such fields like this. All right? Now, in the growth survey strip, we're going to do things slightly differently because this is a region of the sky that has been targeted by a lot of other astronomers for many other panchromatic observations. In particular, there's already HST data down here. There's XMM data over here. There's going to be Chandra data here. And CERDF is going to scan right down this strip with all seven channels of its infrared cameras to very great depth. So we're working in conjunction with the CERDF team, and we said, okay, we'll measure the redshift of everything in this green rectangle. This is 15 by 120 arc minutes. So the survey strategy is slightly different in this field, and so that's a slightly different approach. So that complements the other three fields, but has a lot of advantage. So we will provide them 15,000 redshifts in this field, which isn't too bad. Very hard for them to get otherwise. Now, all this is possible because of a new instrument that was delivered to Keck last winter. And this instrument is called DIMOS, Deep Imaging Multi-Object Spectrograph. It's quite a monster. The beast weighs 10 tons. And it, see if this is live or not. Oh, yeah, it is actually live. Okay, so light comes in here through the hatch. It goes through an entrance mask at the front, then to a collimating mirror, then over to a folding tent mirror, then to a grating, and then into a camera, through a filter wheel and the detector plane here. This camera is a tour de force piece of optical design containing various exotic elements of glass, polished aspherical surfaces. It's a one-of-a-kind beast that's worth several million dollars by itself. Okay. The instrument is large. Here it was. Here it is as it appeared in Santa Cruz last year during final assembly. And I'll skip all the transport slides. And here it is delivered at the Naismith deck of the Keck telescope. So this white ring here is the altitude bearing of the Keck telescope. Light from the telescope comes out of that bearing and is focused just outside of the bearing, where the right in the middle of the instrument. The instrument has to rotate about this axis because the field rotates as the telescope tracks across the sky. Okay?
Mark, you ever get the comment that this sure looks an awful lot like a particle physics detector?
Yeah, we've had that comment. It's 10 tons, Phil. This is ridiculous. Oh, where's my other picture?
Where was it filmed?
At Santa Cruz.
I see.
Where did the masks go?
All right, let me show you that in a minute. Let me go through this quickly and show you what happens. Okay, so the field of view is 16 by 5 arc minutes. We can image over that. The whole thing gets imaged onto a detector focal plane of 8K by 8K CCD. That's 8 4K by 2K high-quality Lincoln Lab chips. Very high QE, very low fringing. These chips are just a dream. Very low noise. 2.3 electron read noise. The system has something called flexure compensation, and it works at very high dispersion. So let me show you what I mean. Here's a mask. Not a great drawing of a mask, but this is a mask that's about this big, and that goes at the focal plane of the telescope up in the front of the instrument. Okay, and then the light goes through the mask, and then it goes to the collimator. It's okay, spread out, and then to the rest of the optical system. The mask in imaging mode gets imaged onto the detector. Here's the detector. And in spectral mode, the mirror, one of that folding, the mirror is replaced by a grating and is dispersed in this direction. So we have 8,000 pixels of spectrum for every point in the mask. Now there's two other little CCDs here. There's also in the system, there is at near the mask, there are a couple of fibers that are channeling light from a lamp, a copper argon lamp. That light is dispersed by the spectrograph as well and ends up along here and is detected in these CCDs, which are read out fairly frequently, like every 20 seconds. And the system, the feedback system, is looking at a spot, one spectral spot on this CCD, on that flexure compensation CCD, and it's checking to see that it's in the same pixel, X and Y. And if it moves, the instrument has the ability to, the flexure compensation, where'd it go?
Mark, can I ask a very, very naive question?
Hey, let me just finish this one description here. If the fiber, if the spot moves, this mirror can tilt, or the whole camera can slide in one axis. So there's 2 degrees of freedom to close the feedback loop on the flexure compensation, to hold it electronically rigid, and that keeps the pixel-to-wavelength registration stiff at a level of about a tenth of a pixel.
What's driving it so that it's not in the same pixel as it
rotates? The whole thing is rotating, and the gravity load is flexing it. This instrument is so big it flexes. You can't do anything about it.
So this is probably a very naive question. This is the first time. The mask is just something that's piece of metal with holes in it that
it is a aluminum sheet. It's an aluminum sheet that's been milled with slits.
So it has little holes in it.
Slits.
Slits.
Yeah. And those slits are tilted to follow the major axis of the galaxy. So the field of the telescope will be imaged right on here, and there will be an image of the galaxies right here.
So these are the galaxies you actually study.
Yeah. In those slits. Yeah, so we have to have a custom slit mask for every field that we point at.
So this is just to test your equipment?
No. This is integral to it. Every night, you have to load in the slit mask for that night.
Oh, okay.
You can't just randomly point this at
because
the sky.
Because there's too much background.
Oh, yeah. You're using a slit spectrograph in order to cut out that background.
Okay.
This is your background filter.
Okay.
So a lot of photons are thrown away.
Okay.
Well, yeah, but most of them are just blank sky.
Right.
Okay. Oh, here we go. This is our picture of Allison, who has done a lot of the observing. She's a graduate student working with me. She's done a lot of the observing on this program. So this is what the data looks like. This is a small piece of the data from a raw frame coming off the instrument. The spectra are dispersed in this direction, and what you're seeing is an abundance of OH night sky lines from our atmosphere. This is what we have to look through, and it's sort of brutal. The atmosphere past 7,000 angstroms is just punctuated with thousands of OH emission lines, and here they are showing here, and you can see that they're tilted and all that. That's for the tilted slits. Now, we're working at extremely high dispersion, very unusual for this business. And the motivation for that is that we want to spread the OH lines so far that we can work between them where the sky is relatively dark. This shows you the fraction of the light from the sky background that's coming as a function of wavelength, the fraction of the light that's coming from these bright lines. And it's a high number, like 70 to 80%. But the fraction of the pixels that are contaminated in red is much smaller, like 15 to 20%.
How are you defining contamination?
2 times background. Okay. Anything that's twice background level, we're just sorting it for the purposes of this picture. And this shows you an example of what happens. Here's an hour's worth of data co-added, raw frames. Here's a series of slits. I've now rotated everything, so lambda's running this way. We've got a series of frames. Here's the OH skylines. All these bright streaks across here are cosmic rays. This is a great charged particle detector. So we get rid of those because the data comes in multiple frames, and we process those multiple frames to look for changes. Okay, but underneath are some objects. These are actually spectra of real objects. In the processing pipeline, we clean out the skylines. You notice how these things are tilted as well. This corresponds to the tilted slits that are tilted so as to follow the major axis of the galaxies where possible. So in the processing pipeline, which is now working very well, this is a very small fraction of one mask. We clean everything out, and what we're seeing now is the sky subtracted spectra running this way. And what you can see is a series of doublets. Four of these guys together. This one's not too easy to see on this picture, but there are four doublets here. This is the 3727-3729 O2 emission doublet of singly ionized oxygen that is prominent in nebular spectra of star-forming regions. It's a forbidden transition, very commonly seen in astrophysical situations. This is a unique signature. There's no other atomic line that looks anything like this. Now, that is emission redshift is 3727 angstroms, but we're observing at about 7,400 angstroms. So this is a redshift 1 group of galaxies. These galaxies are all about the same redshift, but you can see that they're not perfectly lined up. There's a little bit of internal dispersion of those galaxies around each other, and that dispersion is of order 200 kilometers a second. And we're going to see hundreds and hundreds of groups of galaxies just like this as the survey goes along. So this is redshift space clustering at Z of 1. And this shows you what the data looks like after you process it.
Mark, I have a question for you on the tilted spectra. Why are the ones that you've chosen all roughly vertical? Do you choose them for that purpose? Or I would expect a random distribution of angles.
Where?
Tilted slits.
Oh, well, the rules of the tilt are the following. No more than 30 degrees, because otherwise the projection into the spectral direction is too modest. And if I don't have information on the size of a galaxy and it's too small to give it a size, it's vertical.
Yeah, that's
the key. So a lot of the small objects just come out vertical, or nearly so.
How long do you integrate each frame?
There's 3 20-minute exposures that went into that. So we're doing it, that's our routine. Here's another mask. Process data showing O2 lines all over the place, an O2 playground. These are unique. So this is what the data looks like in a processed manner. Here's another example showing these two cases here. We're now seeing velocity. This is velocity direction, so we're now measuring the velocity as a function of spatial position on these objects. And so this is the rotation curve of these high redshift galaxies, right in the raw data. Okay, you get used to looking at this, and this. So we're going to be able to derive rotation curves for thousands of objects out of this type of data, just by this type of examination.
Nice.
Now, in terms of the pipeline, we have a fairly fancy reduction pipeline. Here's a raw slit, rather highly tilted. This is what happens after we've processed it and done the sky subtraction. The fact that the slits were tilted did not really matter in terms of the analysis. And it very cleanly subtracts things, usually right at the Poisson level. So we're getting down to being Poisson noise limited. It's really working extremely well. There are systematic bugs of all sorts, but in general, we're at the Poisson noise limit. Here's an example of that. Here is showing the residual of a signal minus the model, based on what we call our B-spline model, relative to the sigma at that point for regions underneath the lines, only underneath the lines, not in the continuum region between. And this distribution is very accurately Gaussian and has the right width, so we're happy about our sky subtraction algorithm, which has been a real problem for faint galaxy spectroscopy in general. Okay, so I said that in one field, the growth survey strip, we're not making a photo Z cut. In the other two fields, we are. Other three fields, we are. Here's an example of from early commissioning data showing the redshift distribution we measured in one of those fields without the photo Z cut, and you can see it extends all the way down to low redshift, and then tails off to higher. If we make the photo Z cut in another trial mask, it indeed is cut off at low redshift. So it's behaving as we wanted it to behave. Okay, we're not sure. What we're trying to estimate right now, and I'm trying to work on, is to figure out what our success rate for spectra is. We think it's going to be in excess of 80%. I hope it's closer to 90, but I'm not certain we're going to get there.
You can use the growth strip. I mean, you can just pretend that you did do the photo Z cut.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's certainly one of the things we will test as the data comes in, is to see how well our cut is working. Okay, so just to summarize where we are, the instrument is working amazingly well. It's been spectacular and very exciting summer. The commissioning began with two S's. I see it didn't get through. Began in June under clear skies and was highly successful. Then the observing campaign began in July under cloudy skies, and it was dreadful. We've had a lot of telescope time. We've had 16 nights of telescope time in the since July, and of those, 7 have been usable.
So your 120 nights, is that 120
assigned? That's assigned. We're counting on 3/4 of them being good.
Okay.
Or two-thirds, and we're not doing that well. So at this rate, we're not making, you know, we're. But it's been a bad year in Hawaii. However, in spite of that, we have observed 53 masks out of a total of 480. And so we are more than 10% completed. And so
now, when the sun was, besides some nights at 2 o'clock and so on, does that introduce bias into the data? I mean, there's not a sharp dividing line, right? Clear enough, not clear.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's really tough because sometimes it's sort of a thin cirrus overhead and you say, well, we really can't shut down.
Right.
But the quality of the data may be dreadful. And so we have to measure the quality of the signal to noise at the end of the day and ask. In fact, we're trying to determine these things right now. Right. When do we decide it's good enough? And at what point do we decide it's so bad we have to redo this field?
Right, but you redo the field anyway, so it doesn't bias the data. Like
we have to either throw it out or redo it, I think.
Either throw it out or redo. Okay, so it's not like some particle physics experiments that have bias.
We'll see how bad. If weather is good, we'll be able to afford to just throw it out and redo it. If the weather continues to be horrible, we're going to be in the unenviable position of having to live with less than optimal data.
Okay.
Another determining factor, which I haven't mentioned, is that we have narrow slits. They're 1 arcsecond wide. And the atmospheric seeing plays an important role here. If the atmosphere, if the turbulence generates the images, makes the images larger than 1 arcsecond, we're dead. We really want the image quality to be 1/2 arcsecond. And then the light is highly concentrated and a good fraction of it falls down the slits and we get good signal to noise.
So statistically, what fraction of time is 1/2 arcsecond?
Well, we need 6 to 8 tenths, and it's, statistically that's about 80% of the time. But you can be stuck. You know, you can be in trouble. All right, so we've not done great, but we still have a lot of data, this flood of data, it's amazing. And if all goes well, we will finish in 2 years. And then we'll continue analyzing it, and hopefully it'll be mostly done in 2 years after that. Now, even though we've only got a small fraction of the data, the team is clamoring to write some papers, and we hope to write about a half dozen or more papers in this, just with the data we have now. And that's, we hope to do that, or at least mostly do that, before we go back to the telescope in the spring. So they'll focus on properties of galaxies as a function of redshift. We can measure luminosity function, star formation rate evolution, line width color, galaxy color evolution, compare it to some of this to simulations, study mergers. We probably have enough data to measure, to get a first cut on the scale length of galaxy clustering. There shouldn't be any great surprise there. Maybe something on velocity dispersions and Tully-Fisher properties. And people are looking at the data to look for unusual events buried in the two-dimensional spectra.
I'm confused. I thought this galaxy color evolution that you wanted to study here, that was your input. Didn't you put that?
That's the input for the selection, but then then people will look in more detail at the nature of the emission lines coming
so you
out.
Improve those curves.
Okay, now, a test that we will not attempt to do for quite a while until we have the data set nearly complete, but is of probably greater interest to the general physics audience, is the use of the survey data for the dark energy test. And what we're going to do, our approach to this is going to be the classic redshift volume test, which I think has not been executed in the past because you didn't have any way to trace things with sufficient fidelity to have any confidence in them. But I think we have some handles that will make it useful. Okay, so let's just go over roughly what's going on. We want to ask what the co-moving abundance, the measured abundance of objects of a given class as a function of redshift is going to be proportional to the co-moving abundance of objects that are there, which can evolve with Z, times some cosmological factors. DC is the co-moving distance to the redshift of interest. That's model dependent. And E of Z is the ratio of the Hubble constant at that epoch to the present Hubble constant. That's also model dependent. So these terms and this are all model dependent. Okay. So you might, if you say we counted objects as a function of some property, how will we use them for cosmological tests? And there are two separate ways to think about the problem. One, the first that we'll try, is to study a class of objects for which the co-moving abundance, N of Z, is not expected to evolve very rapidly, very modest evolution. And two will be to count objects whose co-moving abundance is more sensitive to the cosmology than to the volume element. Now, in the first category, we would call galaxies. We're only going to redshift 1. Galaxies are thought to have formed largely by redshift 2 or 3. And the evolution from Z of 1 to 0 is more modest. Whereas clusters of galaxies are forming now, and their evolution back to Z of 1 is quite dramatic and very model dependent. Okay, so how are we going to measure these objects? We're not going to measure galaxies or clusters by their luminosity or counts of objects. We want instead to measure something that's more intrinsic to the object, although they'll have its own problems. In principle, if you can count objects as a function of the depth of their potential well, then the evolution is less dramatic. We've analyzed this in some papers in the past. And I'll show you exactly what I mean by this in a minute. If we want to count galaxies, in terms of the deep survey, counting galaxies as a function of their line width means that we catalog them as a function not of how bright they are, but of what that internal rotational width is, either from the rotation curve or from the width of those O2 lines, which we can measure, and we have measured. The other method of counting clusters will be not to count them as a function of the number of galaxies, but to count them as a function of something we can measure, the velocity dispersion of the group. How many groups are there with velocity dispersion between 300 and 400 kilometers a second in this redshift interval, for example? That's one way to characterize it. The velocity dispersion is given by the mass and the radius. Okay, and these quantities can be calculated directly, either from Press-Schechter formalisms or by numerical models, which will be more precise but more difficult. All right, and the basic idea of these tests is the following, and this is what gives these tests any power. On the right-hand side is shown the volume element, the differential of volume element as a function of redshift and solid angle, as a function of z for a variety of cosmological models. On the bottom is an Einstein de Sitter volume.
Well, yeah. Are you going to say why you expect the density in these objects to be to evolve little?
I'll show you that. I'm coming to that. So let's just talk about the volume element first of all. The volume element itself is well-known behavior. An Einstein de Sitter volume is much less than the volume element of a lambda CDM model. There's a factor of 3 difference here. And these green curves show the effect of the equation of state parameter W as it varies from minus 1 to minus 0.8, minus 0.6, 0.4, 0.2, 0. So the volume is a measure of the cosmic pressure, the cosmic barometer in some sense. And as you change W, the number of objects that you will count in a volume element is proportional to that. So it's a direct way to constrain W if you can count the number of objects. Now the question is, can you categorize them and understand what they really mean? So in order to do that, you have to have some understanding of how they're expected to evolve. What's shown here is the expected co-moving number density evolution of objects with internal velocity of 200 kilometers a second as a function of redshift for different models. The open CDM, Einstein de Sitter, or lambda all more or less behave in the same way. And they're all, at z of 1, they're all within a few percent, 10% or so, of the same value.
What do you mean? Einstein de Sitter just pure lambda, no matter, is that right?
No, it's pure matter, no lambda.
Pure matter, no lambda.
Okay, the other way around. So if you go to higher redshift, then the Einstein de Sitter prediction is that these galaxies won't exist at high z because they'll be in smaller halos, whereas that turnover radius is at a larger z in these other models. But if we go to low z, we're not very model dependent for the abundance of galaxy-sized halos. That will not be true for cluster-sized halos, for which these curves will diverge fairly dramatically. And a way to see that is to look at the expected, from Press-Schechter considerations, the expected evolution of the co-moving abundance of halos as a function of their internal speed, their internal depth of potential, at different epochs, at z of 0 and going out to z of 4. As you go to the deeper potential wells, they exponentially drop as you go to higher redshift. Those objects become increasingly rare events, and their abundance is exponentially sensitive to that. So you can play this to your advantage to try to understand how to deal with the abundance that we'll observe. So you can go through considerable detail on how to do this, including Monte Carlo simulations. The bottom line turns out to be the following. Including a very large effect for systematic errors, I think a very generous effect for systematic errors in the counting of halos, galaxy halos, including in there some ambiguities about what we're going to measure and how to interpret our internal velocities, we would be able to set, by counting 10,000 halos of galaxies as a function of their line width, which is only a small fraction of our total data, we'd be able to set the following 95% confidence contour in omega lambda omega matter space, this red curve, by counting galaxies. Okay. However, if we count clusters of galaxies and we use a fairly aggressive normalization, we have the ability to set a considerably tighter constraint in omega lambda omega matter space. Now, if we use a fairly modest normalization that retains a degeneracy between the matter density and the normalization of the clustering, we get a much weaker constraint shown as the blue dashed. Okay, the SNAP project statistical error is thought to lie somewhere in this range. Now, that's omega lambda space. A more interesting plot these days is to presume that the universe is flat and that we live somewhere on this diagonal line. We have a flat universe, and the only question remaining is omega matter. The rest of it is in the dark energy term of some unknown equation of state W. And this is a constant W, I'm assuming here. Okay, so translating this red curve into that space, we have this very long banana, half of a banana, that is somewhat worse than the SNAP results. It wasn't worse until we got more serious about our systematic errors. But the systematic errors dominate this test, and it's not very promising.
But this is only 10% of your project.
10%.
Right? Your project is complete, will be much better.
Well, maybe. It's not clear we'll have good dispersions for all the objects. And I don't have great expectations that we'll ever be able to interpret those internal galaxy line widths as well as we would hope. We'll see. So, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. The SNAP result, expected result, 95% confidence is plus or minus 2/10 in W. Whereas the result that we think we can get by counting the abundance of clusters of galaxies is surprisingly tight. First of all, if we don't break the degeneracy between omega matter and sigma 8, then we have a modest constraint. In conjunction with this other constraint will be useful. But if we can break the degeneracy, or other people can break the degeneracy on the matter density, which I think the Sloan project should be able to do, then we can set a very tight constraint on W, just by counting clusters. Now, you note that these set constraints that are highly unparalleled in phase space. And the reason for that is that this constraint, this contour here, is a contour of constant volume. Okay. But in this test, we are not sensitive so much to the volume as we are to the growth rate of structure. And that's a different cosmological combination. And so it means that we're sensitive to the volume, to the product of the volume and to the growth rate of structure. And that tilts the degeneracy of the curve. And so if you execute all these tests together, the joint constraint can be quite promising. I mean, if a miracle happens and the data comes out as good as it might, and SNAP gets data and we get data, then the joint likelihood might be somewhere in this tiny little corner. That's 10 years away. But it could happen. We could get real lucky. Of course, these are timed independent W measures here. And if the precision gets really super duper, you might imagine being able to going after time dependent equation of state.
Mark, can you go back?
Yeah.
I understand the red is the deep estimate.
We have two estimates from DEEP, and I haven't, I left off some details which I could fill in. Maybe I should have filled in. The counting the galaxy halos is sensitive strictly to the volume test. And so when you go through the numbers and work out the statistics of how well we should count objects as a function of redshift, the constraint that you get, including gross inclusion of systematic errors that we've tried to characterize, lead you to this sort of expected curve.
And okay, that's with all the expected data. We'll
set. All the data.
And then one of them is SNAP. And it says that
the SNAP is the black dot dashed curve.
Okay.
And the counting of the galaxy clusters within our survey, where we're going to see a dozen clusters of order coma-like, and hundreds and hundreds of clusters at lower velocity dispersion, depending on the model, counting all of those together shows that we can set a surprisingly strong constraint, because from a simulation or any semi-analytic process, you can compute what the co-moving abundance of these objects should have been. And as a function of line width, that's as a function of internal dispersion, that's the characteristic we'd like. Of course, we're always assuming that the velocity dispersion that we can estimate is a real measure of the internal dispersion of the object, which has its own uncertainty. Perhaps it has bias, which remains to be seen. But there's no great evidence that it has bias at low redshift.
Okay, so that's the dark blue.
The dark blue is that. And a dashed blue would be to do the same, but then say, well, we really don't know what the cluster abundance is supposed to be in our universe, and if you measure it today, it's modulo this degenerate combination of omega to the 0.6 times sigma 8. And that degeneracy is breakable. And Sloan should be able to break it by weak lensing tests, we hope. Other people are trying to break it, but I think Sloan has the greatest prospects for breaking. I'm presuming that they're going to break it at the 5% level. They've got years to do this before we have to apply the test. And this is a motivation. They don't have a very great constraint on W themselves, but if they can break that degeneracy, then it removes a big degree of freedom in our constraint on these parameters and allows us to proceed in this way. But if they can't break the degeneracy, then of course our resulting curve is either here or here and not nearly as interesting. If they break it halfway, then we'll be constrained to some degree.
In the gray.
Somewhere, it'll be some smaller version of this.
And the left about the gray is?
Oh, the gray, I believe, that's right, the gray is current boomerang constrained.
In all these cases, those measurements are independent, right? So
yes.
Even if you have the big contours, you'll have both of those contours. In the
yeah, middle. That's right.
There'll still be a joint.
There's a joint contour, that's right. That's right. So there's a lot of promise here. And counting clusters by the Sonjayev-Soldovich technique is even more promising in many respects because you can cover a much bigger field. We're killing ourselves to cover 3.5 square degrees. I guarantee you we're not going to do this over 100 square degrees. It is not going to happen. Not in my lifetime. But you can count clusters with SZ effect over 100 or maybe even 1,000 square degrees. And if some miracle falls and you can get redshifts for those clusters, then in fact you can set error constraints on this that are much tighter than what we'll be able to set. Because among other issues, the clusters that they will see will be at the tail end of the distribution, the most massive clusters that are most sensitive to the cosmic parameters. Okay, their evolution is most dramatic with the growth rate of structure.
But as soon as you can get redshifts.
Sure does.
Think it's feasible?
I don't know. Photo-Zs are feasible. And that, I think, is a good start. I think real redshifts are going to be demanding. I don't know if, you can do a few hundred clusters. I don't think you're going to do thousands. Maybe you could do thousands over time, but it's going to be demanding. I mean, each cluster, if you use an instrument like ours, you would need a separate mask for each cluster. So you would need... if you use a fiber system, you'd have a separate fiber pointing for each cluster. And so you're talking about how each one pointing per cluster, and each of those is several hours. So it's a lot of time. All right, anyhow, we've published a bunch of papers on this. I think I will stop. You can read those details. Here's some more. I guess I can go show you some more simulations. This shows you pictures of what we expect to see in some of our mock regions. We can't target all the galaxies because we have collision effects. The spectra are not allowed to overlap, but we've convinced ourselves that the missing spectra are not going to compromise our statistics. We've gone through tests in mock catalogs to show that we can recover the differential distribution function of clusters as a function of velocity dispersion. One of these is the solid is redshift space dispersions, and the dashed is real space dispersions of these mock catalogs. We have a very fancy Voronoi-Delaunay partition to do this. We've gone through and shown that you can if you try to construct clusters in real space in a mock catalog and compare it to the clusters in redshift space, which is what we'll have to work in, those distribution functions of cluster abundance as a function of redshift are very similar. So we are recovering the essentials that we need to execute this counting test. And finally, let me just close with the fact that we're not the only game in town. There's another very large project that's just getting underway as well on the VLT. It's the VMOS project. The R is dropped for the moment because that meant infrared. Visible multi-object spectrograph led by Olivier Lefebvre and a large team in France and Italy. Their instrument is quite a bit different than ours. This is stolen from their webpage showing a simulated picture of spectra in their case. Their spectra are very short and they have multiple spectra in one row. In our case, we had a row, or a column, I should say, occupies is a full spectrum for our object. But they, because they have short spectra at much lower resolution than we're working at, they can get a higher multiplexing advantage. And whereas we're really only going to do about 120 objects per mask, they have a four-barreled instrument that's going to do 700 or 800 objects per mask, per pointing of the instrument, with four masks all put together. We were supposed to have a two-barreled instrument, but we ran out of money. If anybody wants to give us another couple million, we could build the other side. So they'll have a higher multiplexing advantage, but instead of working at a resolution of 5,000, which is what allows us to do all this internal kinematics on the galaxies and obtain the very precise redshifts, they're going to do most of their work at resolution 200, which is just a whole different ballgame. And that means that their sky subtraction will be compromised, and they will have a much more difficult time. But they have more money, a bigger team, and they'll be complementary in many ways. Their survey in total is going to be layer caked. The large survey is going to be extremely large. As I said, a high multiplexing advantage. And so in a few years' time, we'll see cluster catalogs coming out of that survey as well as our own survey. And I hope that all people doing SZ work are going to target these fields first, because they have the advantage that the redshifts will be measured for you in advance. It just makes life a little easier for everybody. The VIRMOS fields are all on the galactic equator. That may or may not be convenient for, it's certainly not convenient from the South Pole, but otherwise it's not too bad. We have several advantages, as I mentioned. We can resolve the O2 doublet. They're going to be lucky to, they'll never resolve it. So that makes a big difference. We reduce contamination in the night sky and do all these other science programs that they can't do. But as I said, they have larger multiplexing, and they're going to have full redshift coverage, more bigger sample, and they're going to have an IR component eventually, perhaps.
Can you go back one?
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't think they can do the NBZ?
Well, they're going to have trouble. They're certainly not going to do internal velocities of the galaxies. That's out of the question. They're going to have trouble measuring velocity dispersions for the groups. They'll be able to measure dispersions for the biggest clusters. But that's okay, but there won't be so many of those. So there will be some problems.
So what's their main science goal?
I don't know. you know what it is, Martin? As it was explained to me by Olivier, we asked, why are you doing the survey this way? And he says, when you get 30 people together and everybody has their own opinion, can I say? We have a smaller team, and I have a stronger whip than he does. So we're doing what I want to do, at least in the one-hour survey. We split it that way. I can't tell you exactly what the goals of a three-hour survey are for us, because they're not as well defined yet. But the one-hour survey is very tightly defined in terms of how it's going to be executed. Now, the data, of course, will be all public, hopefully not too distant future, and many people will do many things with it well beyond what we can imagine at the moment. So this will be, I think, something, a legacy for the future. It's going to be very difficult for people to replicate this kind of data for many years to come.
You're doing readouts every 20 minutes, I think you said.
Yeah, our data flow is about a gigabyte an hour.
Okay, and are you reading out that long because you have to integrate that long to get, so you're dominated by photon statistics rather than read noise, or do you take so long to read
The instrument, no, the instrument reads out in about 70 seconds. It should be 40, but we had to go to 8 amp readout rather than 16 amp mode. So there's not much overhead for the readout. The read noise of two electrons says that the instrument becomes sky noise limited in the continuum region, the dark regions between the OH, in about 10 minutes. So we're integrating 20. We know our integration time in total needs to be about an hour. We need to break it up into smaller integrations, each of which had better be sky noise limited, not detector noise limited. It's got to be broken up into multiple integrations to deal with cosmic rays. That's basically it. We were doing 4 readouts, and then we did a test and showed that you can do equally well on cosmic ray rejection with 3, so that's what we switched to. Okay, so that determines the strategy. Now that's, if we ever get our quick look analysis running well enough, we'll be able to tell on the telescope what our quality of the data is and what the average signal noise of these extracted spectra is, so that we can determine whether it's good enough, and if it's not good enough, we can take more exposures, which would be the case if we're working through Cirrus or in less than ideal seeing conditions. But that part of, we don't have that working right yet. It's just, we had so much to do that it's just exhausting how many details we're trying to deal with at once.
And your age variability is not an issue?
Not really. No, the sky subtraction deals with it locally on a frame. We have, some of our slits are so short that there's no room on that slitlet for measuring the sky with sufficient precision. We're devising, a student is working on a non-local sky subtraction algorithm, which is fairly tough to do, but we're very close to making it succeed. So we're going to apply that. We have certain slitlets on this mat, on each mast, that are reserved for sky only, no objects. Those are going to be used to subtract sky, to generate a sky model for slitlets that are too short to separate the galaxy from the object. So that's a technical issue that we're working on as well. So all the code is reduced, I mean all the data is reduced on our modest little Beowulf cluster in the basement that Martin and I share, and we're able to keep up with the data flow without any great difficulty. I think I'll stop there.